Second tape, interview with Howard Adams, recorded at UC Davis Tecumseh Center on April the 16th, 1980. And on the end of the last tape, we'd just been talking about, the political awakening, you might say, and the ethnic awakening or identity of Howard Adams.
But as mentioned about the fact that Malcolm X was the one that really impressed me and I think stirred me to a political awakening. And I know that because that it was very profound on me, and it very mm-hmm. touched me mm-hmm. very, very deeply, and so that I thought for many days about it. And then after that, what I used to think of, like when the Berkeley students were involved in situations and they were going to get involved in a very serious situation of occupying certain buildings or doing things that was obviously going to lead to violence. And I would listen and be part of the group until they would say, okay, now, those people who are willing to participate in this and you know the results of it, you know the outcome, okay, then we want you over here. And at that point, I would back out. And I felt at that time that I was really being a coward and I was betraying the movement mm-hmm. because now I had begun to identify with what was the civil rights movement in the United States, and it was really the blacks. It was the blacks that I saw. Because I should be brave enough to participate, because I had already started to think in terms of revolutionary activities. But I would say to myself, I would rationalize and say, look, this is your final year for your PhD. You know, all you have to do is just finish your dissertation, you've got it wrapped up, and you've got your doctorate. Now, if you go and monkey around with this, you're going to be expelled from the country. They've already told you that. And I would think, oh, my PhD is worth more than being involved and trying to participate in this kind of revolutionary activity. So I would back out. Mm-hmm. And
how do you see that now?
Oh, I think that now, that was a wise decision.
Yeah, because you wouldn't be here.
No. The other thing is that when I got my PhD, and then I immediately went back to Saskatchewan right away. I didn't go back to Vancouver at all.
Mm-hmm.
I got my PhD, and I right away went back to Saskatchewan. I had no job in Saskatchewan, but I had a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 1965, I guess the beginning of 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was, as far as I was concerned, already sort of an awareness or an agitation by the Indians for some kind of civil rights movement, but it was not organized in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to become involved in that. And of course I had an in because I was Indian. Number one, I was at home, right on my reservation. There are thousands of Indians, and in Saskatchewan they are 10% of the population. They are the only large racial minority.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're on the move, then things could happen. And I had, through that year in Berkeley, for the rest of the year I spent there, I had really developed my own political thinking and moved it to, I think, a revolutionary consciousness. I had become very political, to be sure, because I went to all the meetings, all the activities. I went to the meetings of the Trotskyites, the anarchists, and every group I could possibly attend. And so that I became extremely political. And the more political I became, the more revolutionary I became, because there were a lot of revolutionaries around there who were talking revolutionary language all the time, and that I guess my assessment of the situation was also that the only way that anything will ever be resolved for the minorities means the overthrow of capitalism, because I certainly could follow their thinking in saying that capitalism was responsible for really bringing in and establishing racism within the society. And these institutions are racist. And I could see that, I could understand that. And so I certainly did develop a revolutionary consciousness. And so when I went back to Saskatchewan, I fully intended to, I felt I could get a job of some kind of the PhD, but I wanted to be in Saskatchewan, primarily where, you see, the thing is that I didn't have to establish my identity as Indian, even though I had a problem with whiteness, maybe somewhere else in Canada I might have a problem. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that in Saskatchewan because they all knew me as Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back there, and fortunately though, I did apply for a job at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, which is close to where I live in St. Louis. It's about 80 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And by good luck, I got a job with the university in what was called the Extension Department, and I was to work in community development, which wasn't necessarily my field, but nevertheless,
what
it was a job.
What did you get your degree in?
In history.
In history. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, I had taught history in high school, and so that I felt I had, and I had taken a master's in sociology, but sociology really turned me off somehow,
mm-hmm.
And so I don't know why, because I had taught a lot of history and was involved in a lot of Canadian history.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I got a job in community development, and it wasn't that demanding in the sense that, as far as the university was concerned, there was an opening, and I could fit the position. And also the thing was, they had a token Indian, because you see, things were a little serious in Canada
mm-hmm.
at that time, and the Indians were restless, and so the university was pleased to have a token Indian. So, as I say, I got the job.
So
but
you passed as a token Indian.
Passed as a token Indian, and I was treated as a token Indian on the campus, and I didn't mind it. Because
no, I mean you passed because
yeah.
you weren't token.
Yeah.
And
but what happened was that they asked me to make a tour of Indian reservations and to assess them in terms of, I guess they were really assess them in terms of kind of their economic level of development
mm-hmm.
and somewhat were their problems in terms of either economy or educational or whatever like that. And that was kind of the idea. And so they asked me to make a tour of the reservations, making this assessment. But when I made the tour of the reservations, I was much more concerned in terms of assessing them, in terms of the kind of the political awareness that existed on the reservations and among the Indians. And fortunately, the Indians accepted me as an Indian when I arrived, everywhere I went. So that I got on the inside immediately, and that the Indians took me in intimately and discussed with me the situation. And it was obvious that they were very dissatisfied, very restless, and that some had already moved to violence. But there was really a serious lack of organization of any kind of systematic movement. It was at loose ends, and there was no leadership, and it was just a kind of an anarchistic type of
yeah.
thing.
And spontaneous.
Spontaneous, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Blowing up the police
yeah.
Planes, blowing up the boats for the fishermen that they the go around and
game commission.
Yeah, game commission.
Or
yeah,
some.
That's what they call a game commission, and they have big powered boats to go around and check the Indians in fishing to make sure they don't take too many, and so the Indians blew that up. And they were proud of it, you know.
Yeah, right.
And the thing is that the police didn't arrest them because there were too many Indians in a community like that. If you did that, you'd probably create a lot more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So that when I came back,
what kind of police was that? The Mounties.
That's the Mounties.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Mounted Police. Yeah.
They are perhaps that's interesting. Probably you know, they've got this romantic image.
I know.
Everywhere, part of sort of Canadian propaganda or British propaganda. You see the Mounties and they look nice. They are supposed to be the helper of the underprivileged.
Right. They have.
I see you laugh.
Yeah. I know. They have a very romantic image, you know.
Right.
Certainly, it's. You think of the movie, what is it? Nelson Eddy and whatever her name was, you know, singing Rosemary and all these.
No, I don't know.
Oh, it was very, very romantic.
Uh-huh.
Well, any movies that have been made about the Mounted Police
yeah.
are very romantic. And so that there is this romantic image in the
mm-hmm.
fact that they are very helpful to the Indians and all people who are down and need help and everything. But they are certainly not that. In reality, they are very brutal. And that was one of the things that also was that I had learned, is that the police brutality, mm-hmm. that was one thing the Indians were talking about, is the absolute oppression in their own communities. They're very isolated communities, see, because mm-hmm. they're in the north, and they're, the only way you can get in is probably by plane or boat or something like that. And they talked about the police brutality. And
there's no Indian police like it
no.
there is in the USA.
No.
It's all...
All Mounties.
Mounties.
Yeah, all Mounties. And so that they're anything
are
else.
Are all the Mounties white?
Oh, yes. But I think they have, though, since the Civil Rights mm-hmm. Movement, they have recruited mm-hmm. Indians into the police force now. Those who had finished high school would recruit, they would recruit them. They made special efforts. They would go into schools where they were Indians mm-hmm. and make a special appeal to them for joining them on the police force.
But tells in a way that Indians probably were reluctant
oh,
to
yes.
join.
Very reluctant to join.
Oh.
But they got a few, uh-huh. but there are not many. But on the other hand, even though they have them in the police force now, I understand, is that they do not put them on the reservations.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's understandable because, you know, that leads to real more oppression than ever. And so that it'll, you know, lead to more serious consequences. But anyway, that's what happened. And when I then went back to university and I made out a report, a long report on what I had seen and what my analysis of the situation, and I made it a fairly honest one.
Mm-hmm.
And but the university didn't really accept it. I found that what they did was they just simply filed it away. And
mm-hmm.
they didn't want to know about these situations. And they would do anything else, everything to cover it up as possible, rather than to look at it realistically
mm-hmm.
and say that this is the situation. And then what happened was that the Indians then had some expectations of me, in a sense of being on their side, as they saw it, and being able to contribute in terms of leadership
mm-hmm.
to them, because they started coming to the university or phoning to the university, which is you know, very unusual for them because they don't know what a university is. But they knew where I was because I had let them know where I was. And whenever they were having problems on the reservation with regard to either the police or the priests oppressing them or the school officials discriminating against them, they would often call on me to go out and work with them. And I did. I had to do it on my own to a large extent.
You mentioned the priests oppressing them.
Because the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church are the two main churches or religions on the reservations in Canada. And they are on the reservations there with their churches and with the priests in residence right there. And they work in conjunction with the Indian Affairs Department and with the police, and they are part of the oppressors. And in fact, the priests are usually the worst oppressors of all.
Mm. So that hasn't changed. You described that very accurately in your book about
mm-hmm.
the Blue Real War.
Right.
And that hasn't changed.
Hasn't changed at all, you see. Their role as what I call subversive agents,
mm-hmm.
as undermining the Indian society and being agents for the imperialist forces, hasn't changed at all.
Mm-hmm.
And because when I was in Canada, and we had confrontations, struggles, and fights of every kind, the police came down on the side of the imperialists. In fact, they led the struggle often on the side mm-hmm. of the imperialists. And, okay, and, yeah, talk about the priests being very, very oppressive, that really resulted in some cases as being exceedingly oppressive and very violent. But anyway, then what really happened is that I then became almost immediately part of the Indian struggle.
Yeah.
And the Indians started looking towards me as a leader who would help sort of to organize
mm-hmm.
and sort of focus in on some sort of, you know, integrated kind of leadership.
Were you the only Indian PhD?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, a big thing.
Yeah.
That was made news right across Canada, that almost immediately that the news media started to pick up things like that,
mm-hmm.
and I was the only Indian PhD. So that's another reason why I had lost a lot of status and a lot
mm-hmm.
of, yeah, you know, real status
mm-hmm.
among the in the Indian world.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be aware. And you know, fortunately, I think because I had been at Berkeley, and because I had started thinking in terms of revolution, that I also now. That was soon thrown into a position of leadership
mm-hmm.
in what could become a revolutionary movement, which
mm-hmm.
did become a revolutionary movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had to be aware of the problems of being in leadership, because there are many things you can really run into trouble with if you start assuming as, you know, yourself as a revolutionary leader that can, well, can end in disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing you had to be careful of was certainly that you wouldn't be co-opted.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are all kinds of other things. But anyway, I did work towards really, you know, putting this into a real revolutionary movement and putting it on a wide basis, on a whole province-wide basis. And that was the only way I felt it could happen. But at the same time, trying to keep it so that it was a grassroots movement. Because I thought... thing is, if you don't develop it along on the basis of, you know, at the community level, you don't have a constituency.
Right.
And you become just an elitist.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the first people who are going to cut you off are the government, because you've got no support behind you.
Right.
And the media is what you have to watch. The media, at that time, the media were, you know, the moment the Indians became newsworthy, why every... They were always trying to get news about Indians, because that's the same as the blacks in Canada,
mm-hmm.
or here in the U.S. And so that you had to guard against things like that. So it was necessary to develop a movement at the grassroots level. And, that,
mm-hmm.
And so that's what I made efforts to do, was to make sure that there was some kind of political activity going on within the reservation or Indian communities that were not living in reservations but were part of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And developing a certain political consciousness, and that was really important. I felt that, and that was the danger that this,
yeah.
the university and the society quickly perceived it, and so that in Canada, that the university you come up for tenure in 2 years, not like here in 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2 years, they asked me to leave the university, but. I said that I wouldn't, because I was satisfied here, I was happy, and this was my home, and I intended
mm-hmm.
to stay. And so the fight went on for a while, but fortunately, the thing was that the Indians threatened to come on campus and raise hell. I had support from labor groups, and I made sure that I had linked myself up with the Farmers Union,
mm-hmm.
a very large organization, and the students on the campus at that time also were quite radical, and so I had a lot of support,
mm-hmm.
and the university just backed down, because, and the other thing is that what they, I had going for me was that they said, he is a radical from, a revolutionary from Berkeley, and that he is no doubt very well versed in revolutionary action, and he knows how to handle a situation, and that he could cause us a lot of trouble because of his knowledge, and so I had as I say, my training at Berkeley helped me.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure it did.
So certainly I was very involved with the whole movement all the time. Then what they did, though, they took me out of the university. They wouldn't allow me to go to the reservations.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took me out of the, as a result, though, out of the Extension Division and put me in the College of Education,
mm-hmm.
where I had to teach educational history and things of that nature. And
to keep you occupied.
Yeah, keep me occupied. But the thing is, they could not stop me from going then, from going to the reservations on my own time or
yeah.
on the weekends, in which I did. And I became very involved
mm-hmm.
in the whole movement. And of course, I, you know, I continued to get increasingly involved, and the movement continued to develop. And then it's necessary to develop all kinds of sub leaders and other people who can occupy important positions, because if you don't develop leaders along with you, then all they need to do is just bump you off and then they cross the movement. So
right.
you can't make yourself
no.
in a position where you are indispensable.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be dispensable.
Right.
And that was important, so that I was careful to do all that. And I think the education I had learned in Berkeley and the fact that I had also had perceived a lot of these things as I went along in the movement, that helped to develop sort of a revolutionary position, and that's exactly how I functioned and how I tried to develop the movement, and it did go along that way. In Saskatchewan, it was the leading province throughout Canada in terms of the Indian civil rights movement. The Indians all through Canada looked to Saskatchewan for leadership all the way through the whole civil rights movement. And because we were out in the forefront in terms of revolutionary activities and the kind of political things we were doing, we were not necessarily achieving that much in a sense of materially or economically, but politically, we were highly organized and moving as a group who had a certain political awareness and could handle a situation and had power in that respect.
Mm-hmm. What name did you give yourself?
Well, various, I guess we called ourselves various groups. We didn't have really, eventually they became an organization which was simply called the Federation of Saskatchewan Indians,
mm-hmm.
kind of an umbrella organization.
Okay.
But underneath it we had several groups.
Because
it was necessary to have ad hoc groups.
Yeah, and on the grassroots.
At the grassroots, because the thing is, then they could take action. You know, if you want an ad hoc group to take some action, which was probably illegal and maybe violent, so that ad hoc group could, participate and commit the action, whatever it was necessary, but then they could disperse immediately,
right.
And they were lost. So that's how we operated largely. And we did a number of things, to be sure, you know, in terms of taking over control of a school in one case, and we tried to, establish things that were, what we were concerned with was control, autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted control, our own control over the reservations, in terms of decision making with regard to finances, with regard to the whole management of the reservation,
mm-hmm.
and all of these kind of education. And that's what we really wanted. And we didn't want things like more houses and more sort of kind of reform programs that would only serve to co-opt our people.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to get them to understand that we really had to go in terms of real political power. And that's generally the way we moved. Although we didn't achieve it, we achieved a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. And what became of it eventually, or what's the situation now?
Yeah, unfortunately, like a lot of the civil rights movement in the 70s, mid-70s, it died out. But what happened in Canada, I know what happened in Canada, is that the government worked very hard and they succeeded, because I would say that the Canadian government is very clever and very sophisticated at handling colonized people, because they are part of the British Empire and they have been well schooled in how to handle and analyze the colonized people in their situation. They're much more sophisticated than I would say the CIA or the BIA even here, because they have had years of experience of this, and they really know how to work it. And so they co-opted a tremendous amount of leaders who were actually worked with me, and who, you know, we would shake hands on it and say that we should die together if we had to. And those fellows were co-opted, sold out totally, because the government paid a high price, you know, would pay salaries of $50,000 for them even in those times, and buy them off. And that's one of the things that the British imperialist system does. That's part of their policy, is that you can choke them with money, or you can kill them with money.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it.
Yeah.
And they just poured money into the reservations and all the Indian communities, you know, just like nothing.
Did that have a result also when you poured a lot of money into the reservation, or a group of people who haven't handled it before, that they started fighting amongst themselves?
Exactly.
Well, that's a technique that's used a lot. You don't even have to buy them off, you just dump a large sum and they'll kill each other, right?
That's exactly what they did. Mm. And in fact, one organization was getting, the amount of money when I left, was getting $3.5 million a year, an Indian organization, just one. No, and that group were really almost ripping off the whole thing and not going to the benefit of the Indians. And talk about internal fighting.
Mm.
It became so serious just before I left that it really was internal fighting, because what happened, these people who were receiving these $3 million became actually goon squads for the government.
Mm-hmm.
They turned against their own people and started to dominate them and harass them and hassle them and everything else. And they would have meetings whereby they would call me, ask me to go to their meetings and help them try to, if it had to do with education or housing or whatever, but they were politically aware. They knew
mm-hmm.
the situation. But they just wanted sort of some maybe expert advice. So I would go to their meetings. But what would happen, some of these members of the goon squad would show up. They were Indians, and they were very powerful. By now, they were very articulate Indians. They were very aggressive Indians. They were very brutal and bully in their way. That some of them, many of them, were ex-cons or people who had lived on Skid Road and who had really were rough in life.
Mm-hmm.
And they would show up in a meeting and totally wreck it, disrupt it completely. And it would end up in violence. And what we had to think of was, at different times at meetings like that, was that if we are having a fight, an actual physical fight in a hall like this,
mm-hmm.
in a town, the police are going to come and arrest all the Indians for brawling.
Right.
And that's exactly our image.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the government was able to develop these goon squads very effectively.
How were they paid? I mean,
paid?
They must have a certain certain position to be on any payroll.
Yeah.
So. What were they officially?
Yeah. See, what happens is that the Indian organization becomes, like as I say, the Federation of Saskatchewan Indians,
mm.
call it that. And then what happens, there was a sort of a non-status, that was a status Indian organization.
Mm.
Now, the non-status Indian organization would be called some non-status Indians of Saskatchewan. Now, what happens is that there are the board of directors, and that board of directors then acts as sort of the administrative body, and they have a secretary and a chief and so on, and they receive the funds. Now, they also then, what happens is that they hire a number of people for various positions, like community development workers, or court workers who are going working in the court to help the Indians who are in trouble to interpret for them, because many of them can't speak English. And they would have people who worked in housing and things like that. And so they had a number of employees.
They were just slots. Right?
They were just slots, right. But you see, often the same people who were on the board would also, they'd hire themselves.
Right.
And give themselves that money, pay themselves, like say, $50,000 a year. And travel expenses and things like that. So they had a lot of money, you see, and they could travel anywhere if necessary, fly. And they also had big cars and expense accounts. And they were able to, and they were well mobilized and organized and able to do these kinds of things. And they were largely responsible for crushing the movement.
Yeah.
I would say that. So, and then they would do things also, though, that it is kind of a bit of a contradictory situation in many ways. In order to make it legitimate, and whereby the white people would, the white people were involved to a large extent because, not it was their tax money, but also that they were pretty threatened by Indian movement in the 60s. So then they had fear of what might be taking place. They don't want a revolution in Saskatchewan. So that they turned against Indians, to be sure. And you can be sure that the whites turned against me. And whenever I'd be on talk shows, I'd get a lot of phone calls, they'd complain very, very bitterly about me and say, that you are just the type of person that creates all kinds of trouble and you stir up all the Indians, and everything was happy, fine until you came here and got the Indians, you know, on the warpath and all this kind of nonsense. And, you know, the white people became very, but they became terrified more than they became, then they wanted to help the Indians. They were no longer lovers of Indians, I assure you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had long since lost the Indian lovers.
Because they weren't in control anymore. Right?
They weren't in control, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't even be paternalistic anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Indians would say, you know, to hell with you, we don't want any of your help, look.
Mm-hmm.
We want control of our own affairs.
Yeah.
And, you know, your help is not the kind of help that we want.
Mm-hmm.
So, get out. In fact, what happened was that Indians would hold meetings. And
mm-hmm.
when we would hold public meetings, and I wasn't the one that would make the decision, but the Indians themselves would say, look, there's a white man in this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want him in here. Now, that white person may be really a good friend of someone there and is probably the best Indian supporter they could
mm-hmm.
have.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, just simply because, you know, it became such a hostile kind of movement, and Indians, because they're so oppressed and so discriminated against,
mm-hmm.
and I was hostile,
mm-hmm.
but I wouldn't be the one that necessarily would order them out,
mm-hmm.
but they would say, you know, throw them out. We don't trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And so whites were not allowed to come to our meetings. They were
mm-hmm.
forbidden. But I perceived it differently. I would think of it this way. Just the very fact of a white person
mm-hmm.
in the meeting, the appearance of that person colonized the whole meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you see, they would see the white person